morning. This is Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter. The first bow and arrow is believed to have been used around 12,000 years ago. But with the rise of guns, archery fell out of favor. Now it's being revived with the help of school programs across the country. But first, most of the fresh water on Earth isn't held in rivers, lakes, or streams. It's in massive ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. Those ice sheets hold a valuable record about the past climate of Earth, but now they're melting at an increasingly fast rate. We're talking today about how scientists at the University of Kansas in Lawrence are studying this phenomenon. Joining us is Prasad Gojanini. He's an electrical engineering and computer science professor at KU and the director of the Center for Remote Sensing of Ice Sheets, or CRESIS, based at KU. Professor Gojanini, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, let's kind of define what we're talking about here. What is an ice sheet? How is it different from, you know, maybe what we're more familiar with, a glacier?
The glaciers are, ice sheet is basically the extent and the size of that is defined as an ice sheet. And basically a glacier is part of an ice sheet through which ice, you know, flows into the ocean. So that's the difference between an ice sheet and a glacier.
And these are truly massive amounts of ice.
That's right.
You know, it's pretty much all of Greenland and Antarctica.
Yeah, if you think about the Greenland ice sheet, it extends north-south about 2,000 kilometers or about, 1,200 miles, and about 600 to 700 miles in the east-west direction. And at the deepest part, it's about two miles thick.
So, they always talk about how many stadiums you could fill. That's a lot of stadiums there.
Yeah.
What can we learn by looking at these ice sheets?
I mean, you can't learn by just looking at them. But whether the only thing you can see is if you look at them through a satellite or make images, you can see if they are growing or retreating in terms of what is happening with respect to the climate change. The amount of retreat is usually small. You can measure that, but still it's small. But what you can get out of this is basically by studying the ice, taking deep ice cores, you can learn about past climate, what happened to past climate, what was the gas concentration, CO2 or methane or other gases at the time the ice formed or the snow, you know, the atmosphere fell into the snow or fell as a snow. Third thing is we can learn what was the temperature at the time. For example, recently the University of Copenhagen, in collaboration with 14 other countries, completed a core which is about little more than a mile in thickness. And this core actually provided clues to what would happen in a warming climate that we are having today. There was a period about 115,000 to 135,000 years back called Eemian. The temperatures at the time were about 8 plus minus 4 degrees warmer than today. Mm-hmm. So that provided an analog to what we might see in the future. So by studying these ice sheets, we can get clues about what was the climate in the past, what would happen to us, and so those sort of things could be inferred from the ice sheets. And another thing is ice sheets control the sea level.
Mm-hmm.
If the ice sheets grow, the sea level goes down. If the ice sheets retreat, the sea level increases, and that's one of the things that we're trying to find out.
And what kind of research specifically are you guys doing there? You use some unmanned aircraft and radar technology?
Yeah, we have been performing or measuring ice with radars because the radars are the only way to measure how thick is the ice over a large areas. And we've been operating these radars since 1992 on NASA planes. And we built some excellence in that area at University of Kansas, and taking advantage of that excellence, we proposed a major center called Science and Technology Center, and that center has a lot of components, includes technology development to develop radars and UAVs, and it includes field investigations to go make measurements, and then develop models to use this data and also predict what happens to the future by using these models in a warming climate. And in addition to that, the center integrates the education all the way from K through 12 to the doctoral education.
Well, you mentioned UAVs. What does that stand for?
Unmanned aerial systems or aircraft.
So in common parlance, would we call these drones?
That's right,
okay.
Drones.
Well, why use these unmanned aircraft versus, piloted airplanes?
There are two reasons. One is that the areas that are changing are confined to narrow valleys. There are hills on the sides of these glaciers that are flowing through these valleys. And if you really want to understand why glaciers are changing, we need information about these areas that are undergoing those changes. It is very difficult or dangerous to fly crewed aircraft or manned aircraft in these areas over a tight grid by repeatedly flying over the lines. And whereas drones or unmanned aircraft make it possible to fly very close placed lines in these dangerous areas and also keep the costs down. For example, if you take something called a twin otter aircraft over which we operate the radars, it can fly over a 800-kilometer area or a distance. But if you take a UAV that can do the same thing as this aircraft, it costs 1/20th of the fuel. And in the long term, it also reduces the cost of operations in polar regions, and that's why we're using the drones or UAVs.
Well, where do these aircraft fly out of, and where are their, on-land pilots?
Basically, at this stage, we're not at a stage where these drones are completely operational for us. We're still in the development stage. When we go there, we station at a base. Like if we go to Antarctica, there's a base called McMurdo, and we station there and fly from there for the test flights. If we go to Greenland, we will go to some coastal cities where it's possible to operate these drones, and the crew stays on this area. And one time that they went to Greenland, they stayed on the ice in a base camp and operated off the ice runway.
Is it important to have the crew that close to the area?
At this stage, yes.
So no one's sitting in Lawrence operating a drone in Greenland or the Antarctica. Okay, well, we mentioned that you guys use radar in these drones. How does that work to determine the depth of the ice sheet?
The radar measures basically by transmitting an electromagnetic wave and measuring how long it took to go to the target and come back. So with respect to ice, what we do is we send an electromagnetic pulse and measure when the pulse comes back from the surface of the ice and from the bottom of the ice. And that we convert into a thickness, that measurement, and then create what is known as the bed topography maps that show how deep is the ice and how the bed looks like, what are the conditions at the bed.
Okay, you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guest is Prasad Goganini. Sorry about that. We're discussing ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica and research based out of KU. We were just discussing how you determine the depth of the ice sheets using radar. Oh, what have your findings been?
Overall, actually, if you look at, you can't take only the radar measurements in isolation. You have to combine radar measurements with all other observations. By combining this, what we found is margins of the Greenland is retreating or melting, and parts of West Antarctica are also melting quite significantly, and the middle of the ice sheet really is growing slightly or not changing that much, but overall we are losing ice. And so we really do not know what is causing this change. There are various hypotheses. The one of the hypotheses is that ocean around these ice sheets warmed, and that caused the something called ice shelves and ice tongues to melt. When they melted, It's like removing a cork from a wine bottle so the wine can flow out. It's similar to that. Ice is flowing out faster to the ocean.
Okay. Well, Kansas City, have you visited Antarctica or Greenland, or are you curious about ice sheets and the research being done on them? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You mentioned that one of the theories was that these ice shelves and kind of uncorking the ice sheets and basically caused by warmer water. What can the ice sheets tell us about global warming or climate change?
Ice sheets by itself can't tell about global warming, but they serve as an analog to what might happen in the future. And in a way, I'm not sure this is really the way to think about it, but ice sheets are responding to what is happening to our climate. And they also, so there are some interactions between the ocean and ice. So if ocean is going to warm, these shelves disintegrate. When they disintegrate, the glaciers buttressed by these shelves speed up. This happened in Antarctica. They sped up by a factor of 8. So is this instability caused by these ice shelves going to stay there, or is it going to transmit it to the middle of the ice? See, by melting the ice, it's going to take thousands of years to melt them. But if you disintegrate the ice quickly, then you can raise the sea level very fast.
So if it's like, maybe to use an analogy, plopping ice cubes into a glass of water.
Yeah.
And it raises it up, even though it's not melted.
No, that's right.
Okay, well, is there a particular finding or, you know, some research that you're particularly proud of that has come out of your center?
Yeah, we are very proud of the what we are doing. Is there is a glacier called Jakobshavn and in the west coast of Greenland. It is one of the fastest flowing glaciers on the surface of the Earth. Ice is not stationary, as a lot of people assume. It flows. And it is flowing at almost 17 kilometers per year recently. And one of the most challenging in radioglaciology is to sound and determine how thick is this and what is the shape of the channel through which that glacier is flowing. Through the technology, nobody else could do this in the world since they've been using radars to sound ice since the 70s. But no radar in the world is able to sound this glacier. We are the first group in the world to sound it and create what is known as the bed map and define the geometry of the channel, which is very important to developing the models of this glacier and ice sheets, and that's what we are very proud of.
Okay, and we have a caller to 816-235-2888, Jack in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And what's your question?
Well, he was making reference to the Greenland ice sheet, and perhaps he could explain what happened last summer, because I thought the whole glacier on Greenland kind of melted off.
See, what happened last year was basically there were parts of Greenland ice sheet is divided into zones called percolation zone, dry snow zone, and melt zone. And see, dry snow zone, the idea is it never melts. The snow is always dry. The temperatures are below freezing, etc. But the first time in about 150, 180 years, even the dry snow zone, there was some surface melt. The temperatures were very warm, and that caused the iced snow to melt and create a surface melt. And that's what happened in Greenland. And this happens once in 150, 180 years.
So the ice sheet itself is still there, but it was just some of this other snowy, icy area that melted off.
It didn't melt off. Oh. Only thing is you melting. The surface never melts in the dry snow zone.
Okay.
And basically, in this case, they found that there was a little bit of surface melting. And that's what happened.
Well, does that answer your question, Jack? Okay, he's no longer with us. But, I hear about ice sheets, Greenland, Antarctica. How did the center end up at KU in the middle of the United States?
KU has an excellence in remote sensing program, microwave remote sensing. And when I came to India to KU to study, my advisor was involved in various sorts of remote sensing. One of the remote sensing projects was to look at the sea ice, which is different from the glacial ice in Arctic at the time, because there was a lot of interest in Arctic because of the natural resources, oil and gas, which is again happening today.
Yeah, in Greenland, they're very excited. Oh, okay.
In Arctic, which is Greenland is part of the Arctic. And so at that time, Navy had a program that sponsored the remote sensing to look at, to measure how thick is the sea ice, etc. So I started on that program. And through that program, again, we developed an excellence. And when there was an opportunity to put a radar on a NASA plane, the gentleman named Bob Thomas, who was at the NASA headquarters at the time, asked me if we could do it. And I said, yes, we can, and we proved we can do that. And that's how it started. And so we expanded that program to a major research activity at Kansas.
And you came in kind of through the engineering side of things and not through a meteorological background or something like that.
Yes, I'm training an electrical engineer, trying to build radars for remote sensing and apply it to various targets.
And does the center bring together people from those different backgrounds?
Yes, we have aerospace engineers, electrical engineers, geologists, geographers, glaciologists, and education folks involved in education, K-12 education involved with the center.
Okay, well, we have another caller. John from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, and how are you today?
Well, just fine. I just waiting for the snow.
Well, I think a lot of kids out there are probably joining you in that. But what's your question for Professor Goganini?
Well, I was wondering if he had heard, has been staying up on the chemtrails, and if he's heard of the HARP project.
No, I haven't.
Okay. It's under an article here of geoengineering HARP and chemtrails. And they say that the chemtrails, has the aluminum in it. And I heard someone talking the other day that these chemtrails with the aluminum is affecting the land and the ocean, and possibly causing the methane gases from leaking at the bottom of the ocean, and that is part of the problem with the ice melting.
Well, it sounds like that might be a different show, John, but thank you for calling. You mentioned that only parts of Antarctica are the ice sheets really melting off. Why is that? Why is that different in different parts of the?
Because it depends upon the location and the temperatures. East Antarctica is very, very cold, and a lot of the East Antarctica is on the land, and it's not in contact with the ocean as much. And whereas West Antarctica ice sheet is basically below the sea level, is in direct contact with the ocean. So what is happening to the ocean has a much more impact on the West Antarctica. And so a lot of the outlet glaciers that carry ice to the ocean, they are actually changing quite rapidly. And in fact, there is an area called Thwaites Glacier, and it actually losing mass. And I think one of the reasons it may be losing mass is the snowfall is decreasing in that area. But recently, our study showed that the snowfall stayed steady for the last 30 years. All of the mass loss is associated with the really ice dynamics or ice melt or the losing mass.
Well, and I've got a question that just occurred to me here. Have you yourself been to Antarctica?
Yes, I have been. I used to go to Greenland almost every year from 93 to 1999. And Antarctica, I've been only there once and stayed on the ice for about 2.5 weeks.
And how has that been? You know, I think it's a place where very few people on the whole go. What's it like being down there?
When I went to Antarctica, that was much more comfortable than when I went to Greenland in 92. Greenland in 92 was a small camp we have to set up ourselves, 5-6 of us, and do various sorts of measurements. But when I went to Antarctica, I went to a camp called Western Ways, Western Antarctica Ice Sheet, Ice Core Drill Site. This camp is well manned or crewed, and there's a lot of people, so there were comfortable tents and everything else. Again, we went there to test a radar to make measurements, and those radar data are being used to interpret some of the ice core information from that site.
So you weren't roughing it in Antarctica like Greenland. Almost counterintuitive there.
Yeah.
But you mentioned K-12 education as part of the center. How do you reach out and make this accessible to, you know, students as young as 5?
Actually, there are two ways. One of the things is we are preparing certain science-type lessons, drawing on the ice. We have a lady, and she actually goes to the schools, some few targeted schools, and works with the kids in the science area and actually gives science lessons. And that's how we're working on the K-12 area.
And is this something that the young students are interested in?
I think the response has been extremely positive. Actually, we're working with a school in Wyandotte County, and we are working with some schools in Topeka. And the response from the kids is extremely positive. They do the experiments. We give them a set of instructions how to study how ice flows, how to measure temperature, and what is in the ice core, etc. And those kids do those experiments, and they participate in Science Day and other things. They're quite excited about these experiments.
Well, Ed, you know, KU and going to Antarctica and Greenland, this seems like it's really a global effort to research these ice sheets. You know, as far as I think you mentioned some research out of Denmark as well. What is that global collaboration in researching these?
We have a very strong partnership. We have collaborations with folks in Denmark, UK, Germany, and also Australia. So we have visitors from there, and also our students go spend time in these places doing research. And in fact, we have 2 graduate students from University of Copenhagen right now at our center for doing research. And we also actually will be building a set of radars to operate on a German planes in the future, next coming years. So we have very strong international collaboration. And polar research generally involves that international collaboration and a very strong component.
Okay. Well, Professor Gojanini, thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you here. And we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll talk about the resurgence of archery, especially among kids and teens. Central Standard returns in just one moment.